Chapter 22. The Death Pits. Glenn Oscar Gill was popular with the ladies. The numbers were on his side, of course, but it wasn't just that he was one of few men in the Grove wing of the Brighton Rehabilitation and Wellness Center outside Pittsburgh. His daughter attributed his many girlfriends to his brilliant blue eyes and charm that endured despite the dementia that had him lost in time, slipping through broken memories of a life in decline. Jody Gill got to know the women on her weekly trips to the massive for-profit facility in Beaver, Pennsylvania, and brought them cookies and gifts. She knew they did not receive visitors. Then COVID hit and the center blocked visitors. When it finally came time to reunite with her dad in spring 2021, she thought of him and then them. It had been more than a year since she'd been inside the site of one of the worst nursing home outbreaks in the country. A year since she'd held his hand, hugged him in his wheelchair, and humored such imaginings by him as, "I had to work this morning and it was a pain." "I know you did," she would lie. She was the only living person he remembered with any consistency, though he remembered vividly the ancient details. He knew the two loved to go to Steelers games. Every November 2nd, he asked Jody to send birthday flowers to his grandmother, who had died many decades before. Easter 2021 was around the corner, so Jody, a festive person, procured a bundle of white and pink rabbit ear headbands, which she planned to share with the residents and staff. As she finally embraced him, she sobbed. Her father hadn't a clue as to why, he just smiled. She placed a pair of ears on his head and handed some out to the young female nurses who had managed to keep him alive. Four of them huddled around the old man for a photo, and he joked, "I'm like Hugh Hefner, I have my bunnies." Jody looked around. "Where are your girlfriends?" she asked her dad. "I don't know," he replied. "They must have gone to the store." Jody looked to one of the nurses, whose eyes confirmed it. They were not coming back. In this moment, she was grateful her father could not remember the ordeal they'd just endured. More than 80 of his fellow residents had been killed by the virus. More than 400 of them, including Gill, had been sickened, as had more than 200 staff members. As he sat alone in oblivion, her year, just as countless others with loved ones locked in nursing homes, had been one of anxious fear and impossible patience. He was lucky to be alive. Almost one in every three Americans who died of COVID was a resident or worker in a long-term care facility. That figure may change over time, but the trend remains. There are some obvious reasons for this, including that elderly people are especially susceptible to the virus and are more likely to have compounding health issues. Still, more than 30% of our dead were supposed to be in the safe hands of medical professionals, but were captive in buildings where the virus was allowed to spread like wildfire. In April 2020, amid the first of many devastating nursing home outbreaks, a headline in the New York Times labeled America's nursing homes death pits. Horrific as the numbers are, they are not surprising. Nursing homes are a highly profitable business in which a growing number of secretive companies and private equity firms have incentives to lower costs, as they also take in medically fragile people whose needs yield a higher reimbursement from the federal government. The more needs a patient has, based on acuity level, the more programs like Medicare pay to nursing homes. More high acuity patients, plus less spending on actual care, equals profit. Taxpayers fuel these enterprises through billions of dollars in Medicare and Medicaid payments. It can get complicated, but in general, whatever companies don't spend on care and upkeep can be realized as profit or absorbed through some perfectly legal accounting tricks. The mechanics of nursing homes and federal spending are so attractive that total investment by private equity firms in the space jumped from less than $5 billion in 2000 to more than $100 billion in 2018. Total nursing home spending is expected to exceed $240 billion a year by 2025, according to one estimate. Numerous studies have shown for-profit nursing homes are more likely than government-run or nonprofit facilities to be flagged by regulators for issues such as infection control failures or thin ratios of medical staff to patients who need them. About 70% of all U.S. nursing homes are for-profit. With an eye on profits, such facilities often curb full-time employee hours or employ lower-wage vocational nurses rather than more expensive and better-trained registered nurses. With low pay comes increased turnover and fewer healthcare workers per patient. As with so much in the American health system, it is patients who suffer, so the bottom line does not. One 2020 study examined more than 18,000 nursing homes, about 10% of them owned by private equity, and found nonprofit versus profit could mean the difference between life and death. Those researchers discovered that short-term mortality, people dying not long after being placed in a nursing home, was 10% higher at facilities owned by private equity. That study, commissioned by the federal government, estimated that meant more than 21,000 deaths over a dozen years. The sample predated COVID. Jody Gill knew none of this when she came to the painful conclusion in fall 2019 that her father needed to be placed in a home. He'd suffered a serious fall, and the doctor said he now needed 24/7 care. The youngest of three girls, Jody was the kid he had worked most to make in his image, the one who became his co-pilot through loving indoctrination. In his old age, she was the natural pick to be his caregiver. Despite his cognitive decline, they did everything together. NASCAR races, football games, museums. She still practiced immigration law and taught full-time at the Penn State Extension in Beaver County, on the western edge of the state. For as long as she could, she would bring him to her office. Every day, she joked with colleagues, was "bring your father to work day." But he was now running off and getting into trouble. She could not do it alone. So she picked the nearest place that could take him, Brighton, a sprawling campus with more than 500 patient beds that a corporation had purchased from the county in 2014. Even before the virus came, Jody had problems with the facility. She'd show up to find her dad was unclean and unkempt. His nails had grown too long, and his eyeglasses were either missing or so dirty he couldn't see through them. She remembers the facility itself was often dirty, observing, for instance, feces in the bathroom, stains on the walls, and food on the floor. Her father's linens were soiled or dirty, as were his clothes. She took it upon herself to manage his laundry and bought clippers to cut his hair after many weeks of requesting he be scheduled for a trim. She began to work the nurses, developing personal relationships with as many as she could, with the hope that they would take extra care of her father. Federal and state regulators had noticed problems too. In early 2019, federal inspectors with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services arrived to find Brighton residents bundled up in coats, hats, and multiple layers of blankets because the heat was off. That placed 87 residents on three nursing units in an immediate jeopardy situation, CMS wrote. This went on for days. A few months later, CMS cited the facility for a litany of other failures, including infection control blunders such as failing to supply soap for nurses to wash their hands in rooms where they work with patients and handle medication. Inspectors watched staff violate numerous procedures designed specifically to prevent the spread of disease in such tight quarters. In all, CMS had cited 53 deficiencies in just a few years. In December 2019, just weeks before COVID hit the United States, The Pennsylvania Department of Health cited Brighton again for failing to keep clean and sanitary conditions in guest rooms. They noted multiple soiled curtains, dirty pillowcases, leaky pipes, sticky floors, and broken soap dispensers. The facility had received dozens of citations over many years, records show. This was not a place that was ready for a novel coronavirus, though few nursing homes were. Just a few months after those warnings, in March 2020, Jody learned that a wound on her father's back had tested positive for MRSA, a superbug that spreads easily and can devastate entire hospitals and nursing homes. The spread of MRSA is often a major indication that a hospital needs to literally clean up its act. 6 days later, though she couldn't have known, she'd have her last face-to-face visit with her dad before the facility went into lockdown. By March 11th, the news of a novel coronavirus was impossible to ignore, and she had watched enough to feel terror. But she was shocked to see that day that nothing had seemed to change in Brighton. It was business as usual, people coming in and out, no one wearing masks, though the toilet paper had run out in the solarium. Something changed overnight. The next day, Jody got a call from a nurse informing her that the facility was locking down and visitors were barred. She felt blindsided. Unlike some of the other patients, her father couldn't use a cell phone. She relied on the one landline that served the entire floor where he lived. Over and over, for 2 weeks, she tried to reach him by phone but could not get through to a nurse who could connect them. She began to write to him, though she doubted he could still read. So she searched for colorful greeting cards that could at least convey some brightness to his day, the details of which she could only imagine. On March 22nd, Brighton's medical director made a plea for more masks in an interview with the Washington Post. Several patients were showing symptoms, and they had no idea how to treat them. If he was worried, Jody thought, it must be bad. She went into full panic mode. The last week of March, she and other family members received a phone call. The facility had confirmed its first case of COVID-19. By the weekend, there were more. Many more. As elsewhere, the numbers the facility released conflicted with the Department of Health and news reports. She kept calling. On the rare occasion she could get through, she was told the infections were contained to a separate wing. But by now, she had connected with other families whose loved ones were sick, and they were not isolated to one wing. She believed the facility had lied to her. By the first week of April, the exponential growth of cases and deaths was a dominant news story. She tried other nursing homes to see if she could transfer her dad. No way, she was told, would someone from Brighton be accepted. Jody put on her lawyer hat and began filing complaints with the state health department, local police, and the county. She had no idea what was happening inside, and it kept her up most nights. On April 9th, she received a call that her father had a low fever. Luckily, the test would come back negative. She pleaded with a nurse to connect her to her dad using FaceTime. She did. It was the first time she'd seen his face in nearly a month. That Friday, the facility called again, this time asking her to sign off in case her father fell ill on the use of an experimental drug, hydroxychloroquine, which the president had been touting and responsible doctors and scientists had been warning against in Washington. Someone on staff said the only scary part of using the drug was the potential heart issues, she remembers. Her father had a weak heart. She called friends who worked in medicine, and they told her to ask if he'd be tethered to an EKG to follow his heart rhythms. No, she was told. She remembers being pressured to decide, on the spot, whether I was going to help my dad or not. He had a do-not-resuscitate order in place, so if he got sick and his heart gave out, that was it. Finally, through tears and feeling trapped in a sort of Solomonic dilemma, she gave permission to use the drug. Over the next few weeks, she called the Grove wing several times a day, unable to get through. It wasn't until she threatened a receptionist with calling the police to report a kidnapping that she was finally patched through to check on her dad. A sympathetic nurse gave Jody her personal cell and promised to connect her in the future, a lifeline. On April 16th, local news outlets reported that the county coroner had ordered a community ice rink be refrozen to work as a contingency morgue. They expected the bodies to pile up, and Brighton was the source of most of them. As family members struggled to glean any information from the facility, the numbers alluded to the nightmare within. By the second week of May, 71 patients had died and 319 patients and 22 staff members had tested positive. The Pennsylvania National Guard was called in to provide support, and nurses from Texas were coming in to help. Somehow, her father was just one of about 20 patients at the time who had not yet been sickened, Jody was told. Around the same time, Jody was told that her father was being moved to a new ward designated for patients who had tested negative. A separate ward would house those who were infected. She was relieved to hear the facility was finally following guidelines to isolate sick patients. But this also meant she lost her lifeline, the nurse with the phone, to keep tabs. The new ward, however, had a low window where Jody could at least try to shout at him. That week, she climbed through bushes and stretched high on her tiptoes and was at least able to see him. With the National Guard, some new management, and the intense scrutiny from the state and local media, Jody's anxiety ebbed for a few days. That was until May 28th, when she got the call that her father had COVID-19. He was being moved to the positive ward. The moving around, the pokes and prods and x-rays and tests had begun to take a toll on her father. His hallucinations were getting worse, and the corresponding aggression had heightened. Miraculously, however, he was not showing the worst symptoms of the disease. It was when he got moved to Grove 1, where everybody was supposed to be negative, the people who had never tested positive and who were not positive, Jody told me. That's when my dad got COVID. He got COVID when they moved him. They still had staff moving throughout the entire building, she said. And obviously, we weren't in there, so the only place that they could get it from was from staff. The facility, seeing how thoroughly overrun it was, decided to presume all 800 residents and workers inside were sick. Through all the chaos, Jody spent late nights researching the company that owned the facility, Comprehensive Healthcare Management Services, LLC. The company had very little footprint online. She searched Secretary of State records and tracked the entity to a New Jersey parent company. From there, she pored over the Westlaw legal filings database, following a string of civil lawsuits filed against the company and its subsidiaries. She gathered up what she could find, including the addresses and phone numbers of the parent company's individual owners, and relayed it to local reporters. She also filed a lawsuit of her own against the Department of Health and began to stir up criticism in the local media and connect with a handful of other families who had agonized in complete ignorance of what was happening to their family members inside Brighton. She called her state representatives, members of Congress, county commissioners. She and a dozen other families bound together to file a class action lawsuit against the facility's owners. Most of them had lost people to the virus in the early months of the pandemic. The lawsuit alleges, among many failures, that the facility's management was slow to follow infection protocols. Nurses weren't wearing masks early enough. They weren't trained. Patients weren't separated. And dangerous remedies were administered, the lawsuit claims. One litigant I talked to said he found out his mother was dead from COVID when he got a sympathetic call from her financial guardian. He called the facility, he says, and the nurses on staff said she was just busy and couldn't come to the phone. Even after burying his mother, he never received confirmation from Brighton's staff of his mother's death and the circumstances surrounding it. Bob Daly, the Pennsylvania lawyer arguing the case on behalf of families, says his plaintiffs have ample evidence that the facility and its owners were negligent, and that led to catastrophic loss of lives. They weren't given adequate training with PPE, he said of the staff inside. They weren't wearing it because they didn't have access to it. When the facility did finally procure masks and other protective garb, he says, no one was trained on how to use it. They're not using PPE appropriately. For example, not changing gloves between patients. They're not wearing masks the proper way. I think it's really just kind of a training issue. And I think there was a sense at Brighton that things are out of control, and we cannot ask anyone for help. And they just spiraled. The case will likely take years to resolve. The company did not respond to a request for comment, but has argued it is immune from civil liability because of protections that kick in for healthcare providers when an emergency disaster declaration is called. A 5-month investigation by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, following up on the torturous experiences of Jody's family and others, found that Brighton's owners failed to enforce even the most basic infection control measures that might have saved lives. The newspaper also found that, long before COVID, the company had significantly cut its full-time staff at the facility, setting the stage for the nightmare that would befall its inhabitants. After the company bought the facility from the county for $37.5 million, the company made upgrades so that it could house more complex patients who rely on Medicare, the federal program that covers the elderly and disabled and pays out more than Medicaid. Before the facility was sold, the county received about $1 million a year from Medicare. By 2018, the company had increased that haul to more than $9.5 million, the newspaper found. Profits from Brighton soared. The company pockets yet more money by renting to itself. A comprehensive company manages the building and pays rent to another company, a subsidiary of the same eventual owner. The rent, naturally, keeps going up, from $3.9 million in 2014 to $6.8 million in 2019, the newspaper reported. The company also pays itself a management fee of more than $1 million a year. This arrangement is not uncommon. In this space, as in the larger Medicare-Medicaid insurance space, it's all about finding legal ways to suck money out that would otherwise go to caring for needy people. Two criminal investigations by the Pennsylvania Attorney General and the FBI were launched to look into the company. For their infection control deficiencies, the federal government fined Comprehensive Healthcare Management Services, LLC, about $62,000. The Brighton facility alone takes in about $55 million a year. When the Trump administration set up financial bonuses for nursing homes that had low death counts in the later months of 2020, Brighton was awarded $145,000. The facility qualified because its more than 80 deaths occurred before the program began.